This episode is brought to you by Factor. Optimize your nutrition this year with Factor, America's number one ready-to-eat meal service. Factor's fresh, never-frozen meals are dietitian-approved, ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from 40 weekly options across 8 dietary preferences like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. Eat smarter at factormeals.com/listen50 and use code LISTEN50 for 50% off plus free shipping on your first box. Factormeals.com/listen50. Code LISTEN50. T's and C's apply.
What makes a great pair of glasses? At Warby Parker, it's all the invisible extras without the extra cost. Their designer quality frames start at $95, including prescription lenses, plus scratch-resistant, smudge-resistant, and anti-reflective coatings, and UV protection, and free adjustments for life. To find your next pair of glasses, sunglasses, or contact lenses, or to find the Warby Parker store nearest you, head over to warbyparker.com. That's warbyparker.com.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Can you believe the weekend's over? I hope it was great for you. It was certainly great for me as we had a graduation. I have three graduations in 3 weeks. One is done over New Orleans, where as we're landing on the ground in New Orleans, we find out about a prison break, which is comically tragic. They put these murderers in a minimum security prison, like a holding tank. They move a toilet, go through sheetrock, and run out. And they literally are running around New Orleans while we're there. It's crazy. And they actually videotape of these guys in the French Quarter. So not only are they brazenly, when they leave and get out of prison, they hung out in the neighborhood. Meanwhile, today, First Lady Melania Trump is going to be hanging out with her husband because they're going to have a signing ceremony for the Take It Down Act as it regards to AI and people's reputation. So good job, First Lady in action. We have a lot to discuss this hour, Tim Kennedy, but first let's get to the big three.
Number three.
It is interesting to note that President Trump's, President Obama's, and President Bush II, in their most recent physicals, in their terms of office, did comment on their PSA levels. In the case of President Biden, it was not.
Interesting. In tatters, Joe Biden's cancer announcement takes center stage. We look back at his 4 years as president, and scandal regarding his incapacity is poisoning almost all those people that conspired to cover it up. And we have the Heard tapes, so it takes opinion out of it. And you can make your own decision because he spoke to the special prosecutor.
Number two.
Walmart is, in fact, as you describe it, eat some of the tariffs that just as they did in 18, 19, and 20.
That is the Secretary of Treasury back from overseas talking about Walmart. Made a lot of news by saying, I'm going to have to up my prices and it's going to cost people. That gave CNN something to talk about and MSNBC something to lead with. And then the Treasury Secretary picked up the phone. And it turns out they're going to eat a lot of it. We're going to look at the economy as more trade deals with major powers are on deck. The beautiful bill got chopped up but survives. And Walmart gets backlash. We discuss it all.
Number one.
Most importantly, that's why I came here. I didn't come here to say, gee, you guys are rich and you have a lot of oil. You know, they have a lot of money. And I want them to spend the money in the United States. And we set records. There's never been a trip like this by any president or anybody.
Well, he's stopped in three Gulf states, and he's talking peace, and he's talking money, and he's talking trillions. Intense. That's how I describe the Middle East tour the president went on. As we reflect on the gains made on the president's trip, major movement on Gaza hostages and aid, and Iran denuke talks, not optimistic on that. Couple of reasons. All right, let's start with the president's trip. Three Gulf states, trillions of investment, buying from Boeing, buying from defense contractors, looking to get combined with AI. Why is that important? Because if we don't do it, China and Russia are. Now, think about it. I know these are problematic regimes. I know they got a dicey past. We're also trying to get them into the world economy. And they got enormous potential and great intellect. So if we become partners, we'll have a better looking glass into their society. But this president's going out of his way to say, I'm not judging your society. You can do that yourselves. We're going to tell you, if you ask for advice about running a government and representation, I'll do it. Now, this rubs some people the wrong way. I think it's a very practical way to look at the world. And then, as you see, travel between the countries and trade between the countries, you've seen tremendous gains in a lot of these Muslim nations. And though, keep in mind, backdrop, when President Trump took over, he says, listen, we got to take a look at this Muslim, the Muslim population coming over here. And people say it's a Muslim ban. He says, no, when it comes to illegal immigrants or illegal immigration here, we have to really scrutinize who's coming over here for college or for whatever. After 9/11, after the Iraq War, after the terror attacks that took place here, but he wasn't anti-Muslim. You could not tell somebody that. Oh, no, he's against, but he's not against Muslims. He says most of the terror are coming from those communities. Why are we even having immigrants coming from these Muslim countries without intense screening? So that was a conversation. And if you thought that he was anti-Muslim, I guess that was pretty much thrown in the street, unless you think he had a lobotomy, because he went to three Arab nations. He went to a mosque and he's talking to Muslim leaders who are probably praying four times a day when they're not meeting with him. So, and he's talked, said nice things about the culture. He has no problem with it. So when you talk about the trip, Trump was happy, told Brett Baer this. Cut one.
Most importantly, that's why I came here. I didn't come here to say, gee, you guys are rich and you have a lot of oil. You know, they have a lot of money, and I want them to spend the money in the United States. And we set records. There's never been a trip like this by any president or anybody ever before. And I'd ask him, how about doubling it up? Okay. Oh, I should have asked for more. Because they said, okay.
He did. So he's driving a bargain. Now, it's going to get a lot tougher when we talk about what's happened with Iran and Gaza. I understand that. I have no problem in retrospect they didn't visit Israel. Because what you want to do is keep it to them. Benjamin Netanyahu has been over twice. Obviously, constant conversations about what's happening in Gaza. They've already agreed to get some aid into there. At the same time, intensifying operations in Gaza itself. Now, you saw Jim Himes comment on the president's trip last week. So I thought very curious what Bill Maher had to say. Cut three.
Now we have the Trump doctrine, which is, I think, as much of a departure as any doctrine a president has ever promulgated. Because what he is saying is, and I'll give you some of the quotes, is in the end, the so-called nation builders wrecked far more nations than they built. This is his speech in Riyadh. Interventionists were intervening in complex societies that they did not even understand. Now, I got to say, this is something people on the left said about Vietnam, societies we did not even understand. We said it about Iraq. What are we doing here? But Trump is basically saying, we don't give a shit about what your morality is. And again, it's a hard one for people on the left to argue with, because they're the ones who say America is so evil. So he's his doctrine is basically, you do you. We all love money.
He's being practical. That's a good analysis. And I know the president was upset 2 weeks 2 weeks after the meeting with Bill Maher. Bill Maher had just eviscerated him in a monologue, maybe overcompensated after the Larry David article equated the visit to Larry visiting Hitler, which was just terrible article, terrible taste, horrible judgment. So we'll give you an idea of what happened on that, and also what happened just before we go. So the IDF went heavily into Gaza, and they are. They're cleaning it out, but they also have agreed to get some aid in there. President Trump had an idea. I think it was his, but it was definitely his administration. He talked to Libya and said, listen, you have a whole lot of money since Gaddafi left, and you have not agreed to some of the demands. We've frozen your assets in the U.S. If you want them unfrozen, why don't you take 1 million Palestinians? And it looks like Tripoli, Libya, is gonna take him. Now, I personally, if I'm a Palestinian, I'm saying, really? Sending me to Libya? Almost as bad. I hear it's a mess, fractious, of tribes fighting tribes. But that's what they're thinking, sending 1 million people over to Libya, because they're looking to get people out of Gaza, because it's not livable. The aid is not sustainable. It's hard to get to the right people. At the same time, the IDF is not letting up. They just killed Sinwar's brother, Mohammed Sinwar. They killed Sinwar himself. They killed a lot of the higher-ups, the emotional leaders, the motivational leaders. Kill them all. Hopefully they will wipe out Hamas soon, and we can just get to maybe rebuilding for the Palestinian people next. I want to talk about the big, beautiful bill. Last night, late night, they got a deal. They passed through the budget committee, 17-16. It's going to go through rules, and then they've got to have a general vote. But here's why they're not out of the woods. Chip Roy flat out saying, this bill does not meet the moment. Why? they say, about Medicaid and the work requirements. He wants it starting right away. He also says the future subsidies. Federal government is taking care of a state program in basically 40 states, and they're paying 95% of it. That's why this is out of control. The states don't feel like they got to stay in budget. Now people are getting Medicaid that are not children without parents. They're not the disabled. Medicaid is now going to everybody. And those people that never used to qualify, thanks to Obamacare and what Biden did afterwards, are now part of it. They say the Medicaid money is turning into a laundering scam. Also, what's upsetting people like Chip Roy and others is that they're not getting rid of the total new Green Deal. Why? Because in some of these blue states with Republican representatives, they have these green policies that the people there like. And if you want to get this guy or this woman reelected, you get rid of that program, it looks like a negative. They got to make tough decisions. They're not cutting enough. I know they're not, but it's extremely tough when you don't touch any entitlements and you add in some other provisions like no taxes on tips. There goes some revenue and no taxes on Social Security and no taxes. And there's a few other provisions there. So we had three people who voted present out of respect for the Republican conference. Now they're going to look to move this bill forward, and they're going to talk about SALT, and then they got to bring it, if it does pass by Memorial Day, which is the goal, and I think they'll do it, then it's going to be time for the Senate to weigh in, who has a dramatically different view of what should be happening on the budget bill. This is how Democrats are characterizing this bill. Cut 22.
Well, what we're standing in the way of is the most massive transfer of wealth from the poor and the middle class to the rich in the history of the country. This budget bill is an absolute disaster. It is going to kick over 10 million people off of their health care. Medicaid covers about a quarter of all Americans in order to pass along a new $1 trillion tax cut for the richest 1%. Nobody in this country is asking for that.
Okay. First off, what they're doing is cutting red tape. They're re-upping the tax brackets from 2017 that cook 1% off the top. More people in the middle class benefited from the tax plan than anybody else. And if you look at what they're doing, the projections, this is just came out for us. These are the projections on the effect should this bill pass in roughly its current form. 4.2 million more full-time equivalent jobs. 5,900 to 11,000 higher wages per worker, 7,600 to 12,600 higher take-home pay for the typical family with two children, and $100 billion of investment, 1 million jobs, and hundreds of thousands of new homes to support the workforce's growth in distressed and especially rural neighborhoods. This is the long-term effects of the Trump tax cuts that came across from the Council of Economic Advisers study on the tax impact of the Big Beautiful Bill. So for you just to say, because Donald Trump's a billionaire, they keep saying tax cuts for his billionaire and his friends and Elon Musk, David Sachs are rich. They keep saying that. But I just hope you understand that that's just a phrase used to diminish, which is supposed to be for working class people. That's why he got most of the votes. It's not over what he promised. It's what he says he's going to do, but what he did already. So when we come back, I'll try to squeeze in some calls, 1-866-408-7669. Then Tim Kennedy joins us and will bring us up to date on what's at stake in the Ukraine-Russia war today. President will speak to Vladimir Putin and Zelensky on the phone. Maybe it's a video call. I am not sure. But significant things have to happen because yesterday, Vladimir Putin, to me, showed how insincere any ceasefire talks are. He sent over 100 drones into Ukraine. 100 drones. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, I'm Trey Gowdy, host of the Trey Gowdy Podcast. I hope you will join me every Tuesday and Thursday as we navigate life together and hopefully find ourselves a little bit better on the other side.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I was shocked to see his condition when he came out, and so was the world. And that wasn't the first time he was in that condition. The book makes it very, very clear. There are people who knew and said nothing. And that is a crime against this republic. And I think the Democrats are going to pay for a long time for being a part of what is now being revealed to be a massive cover-up.
And he was started off, Van Jones, I love Joe Biden. I just simply love Joe Biden. But he should not have run again. Ladies and gentlemen, please don't fall into that trap of maybe he shouldn't have run again. The question is, what was he doing for the 4 years he had the job? Of course he shouldn't have run again. Of course. Of course, but he never should have been president. The pandemic allowed him to become president. He was falling apart on the debate stage until Clyburn anointed him, told everybody to drop out, and he just sailed his way to the nomination and then hit his way. And with the pandemic and all the bizarreness, he gets to become president. When it becomes clear he can't do the job, they think that the vice president's terrible, so they think that he can do it. But I know, you know, that there's even more anecdotal stories of Chris Coons seeing him, if he'll ever admit it, in a catatonic state. You know how often all the Adam Schiff and other people are visiting him? Now they say that they never saw him. Not Van Jones, by the way. I think he's the least complicit of all the commentators. One guy that's always been critical is David Axelrod. Cut 33.
And he still says that if he had stayed in the race, he would have won. What do you think?
Well, I think that's preposterous. I think he's being told that by Mike Donilon, his top political aide. And I've known Mike for decades. Mike is a brilliant, brilliant guy. He knows he was a pollster. He was a media consultant. He knows politics very, very well. I think he's just so tied to Biden emotionally that he could not accept the truth, which was it wasn't there.
Are you kidding me? So tied to him? You like the power. That's it. If you cared about the country, you go, you got to step aside. We got to figure out a way to do this. And if you had that little confidence in the vice president, then you do what you just not your problem. She'll take over, do a terrible job, till be primaried, and then a Democrat will pick her or somebody else. But these people like the power, or they just could not care less about Joe Biden. I cannot. And the Robert Hur report. That just shows him all unvarnished, trying to answer unscripted questions without a bunch of people around him. And you see that he didn't remember when his son died, when he was vice president, when Donald Trump took office, let alone the stuff that really would have got him in trouble, why he took all the sensitive material. Remember the defense that they used to have when people like me or somebody, maybe you, would be sitting at home going, this guy can't do the job. He can barely walk. He can't talk. He won't give press conferences. Here's Ian Sams, February of 2024. When Robert Hur comes out to a report that says he's an elderly man who would be sympathetic, who had a poor memory, and said other disparaging things about his performance in those 5 hours, two separate days. Cut 29.
And when you are the first special counsel in history not to indict anybody, there is pressure to criticize and to make, you know, statements that maybe and otherwise you wouldn't make.
Really? So Robert Hur, who, by the way, turned down an interview. He's turning down interviews right now. I want to pull some of the, when Robert Hur had to come and explain himself in front of Congress, these Democrats just ripped him, accused him of all horrific things. He didn't budge. He didn't waver. He didn't sweat. He knew he was telling the truth. So the transcripts were released, but it looks like the transcripts were altered. If you look at the tapes and transcripts, they had edited some of the transcripts. Now, I read the transcripts, and I thought the transcripts made him look terrible, like a doddering old man that maybe looked out, it sounded like he was 104 by the words. Well, then you hear the voice, how thin it is, how confused he got, how out of all over the place he was. Then he calls a press conference after the Hur report's released. And he just defends himself by saying that he said something negative about his son dying. No, you didn't remember when your son died. He didn't bring up about your son died as a test. So half the things that they complained about were totally not true. So I think the biggest story is they knew he was inept. They didn't care that our country didn't have a president. And I think Jill was running the whole operation along with some key aides. Tim Kennedy will be with us. We're going to talk about the big call, Vladimir Putin and President Trump today. What is at stake? He knows the battlefield, also Iran. Should we ever believe him?
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, we are back, and with me in studio is Tim Kennedy, Army Ranger, sniper, and Special Forces operator, and co-founder of Save Our Allies, the host of a new Fox Nation special called General Patton and the Prayer That Changed History. And we're going to get to that shortly. We even have some clips. It looks fantastic. Also, anytime you could see some video of World War II and Patton moving around talking is great. And Tim, we're going to get to that shortly. Great to see you.
It's good seeing you.
Twice in one day. It must be a thrill for you to see me twice.
It's going to be a long day, but we're going to be okay.
Right. To get publicity on this.
Yes, sir.
First off, before we get into it, whose idea was this?
This is actually Fox.
They came to you.
They did. They obviously know I'm a believer. I love the Lord. I love the Bible. And, 20 years in service now, faith has been tested and tried. So, I haven't hidden the fact that I think prayer is important. I don't think I'd exist. I'd be dead 10 times over if it wasn't for my mom and all of her friends praying for us, and all the moms and all the grandmas over there that pray for their kids when they're in combat, for those men and women wearing a uniform. God bless you and keep praying.
Gotcha.
But, that's where it came from here.
Oh, got it. All right. So let's talk about the war that's happening right now, raging Ukraine and Russia. You've seen it up close. How is it?
It's the stuff of nightmares. It's really weird. Having fought in Iraq and Afghanistan, and deployed multiple times to South America and Africa, this is a different thing because it's a first world country, right? There's cobblestones. It's a proper European city. When you go to Kyiv, it's a beautiful place.
Like, was or is?
Is. Kyiv and Dnipro, still beautiful, but always under attack. And so that there's been this disconnect, I think, especially for American military members that have served and have fought in the global war on terror. This, we're in a proper European country, and there's drones and there's incoming sirens for rocket attacks, and everyone looks like us, both sides. So it's a very different feeling type of conflict. And then the war itself with drones specifically, it's World War I style trench warfare that's also using 2025 first-person drones for the most casualty-producing weapon on the battlefield.
And it's just going on and on. But the president says, not going and not with me. So he says he's going to have a conversation with Vladimir Putin today, and then he's going to call Zelensky. Whatever you want to say about Zelensky – He got in line. He's saying, what do you need? Direct talks? I'll show up. You want that mineral deal? We signed off on it. Can I buy stuff off there? I'm not asking. Can I buy Patriots from you?
Yeah.
So defense missiles. So again, if he just says, I need offensive weapons, that might tick Trump off. I'm trying to bring to peace. He says, no, just give me Patriots. I want to be able to knock them out of the sky. So now with all the pressures on Putin, here's what Robert Gates, former defense secretary and CIA director, said about what the president could do today. Cut 48.
Would you advise President Trump not to take that face-to-face, even if Vladimir Putin was willing to do it?
I would say you need to figure out some leverage that you have going into that meeting with Putin. What can you do that puts more pressure to bear on Putin to make him believe his interests are served by not just a ceasefire, but basically at least freezing things in place.
So if that's the challenge, what would Tim Kennedy say, bring up in that phone call?
Yeah, I mean, thank God I'm not the one having to do these negotiations. President Trump is one of the most unique diplomats, and he gets a lot of hate because people don't understand the way that he approaches these kind of diplomatic complex situations. Leverage to him immediately, not surprising, goes to the economy. He starts looking for ways where, okay, what are the things that that Putin needs for him to be successful? Obviously, Russia is huge in energy. So when he's looking, what is happening with gas and oil coming out of Russia? Where does it need to go into Europe? If we start taxing and limiting their ability to distribute and sell their their largest influencer to their GDP being energy.
Right. And who's buying it? China.
That's
who's
right.
buying it? India.
That's right.
Who's buying it? Brazil. And I'm sure there's some other European countries allowing it to be selling them, buying them from there, even though we pushed back on that when Donald Trump took office.
Well, pushing back but not, it hasn't been a heavy hand. You know, it's
not
been,
at all.
No, not yet. But President Trump,
they don't want to affect the global price. But what the president's also doing is drilling down. The price of oil was around 100. Now it's 60.
It's crazy.
So then all of a sudden you're taking half the revenue from him, who's also selling it at a discount.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, these are leverage points. And these are the things that President Trump is going to sit down when he talks to Putin and to Zelensky. Zelensky, since he came to D.C. In a tracksuit, things changed. You know, he learned, you know, I think it's become very clear that the respect from Ukraine, from both the ambassador who I had the privilege of speaking to last month, to President Zelensky, they are falling in line. They're here for a conversation and hopefully for not just a ceasefire, but ultimately real peace talks. But Putin's a tough nut to crack.
Because his objective is to reestablish greater Russia, Soviet Union. And if that's his objective, the question is, from what you've seen in battle, is he crazy like a fox or is he crazy, diabolical? Because does he understand that Trump is giving him his, whatever you think of Trump, he's giving him his best chance of a quick removal of sanctions? He's treating Putin not like the villain that he is, even though it might be pretending, giving him a shot at ending this. An off-ramp. Does he not see an opportunity to have an off-ramp with some dignity?
It's hard for Americans with our view of the world, especially as proud Americans that appreciate the free market and democracy. The perspective of Russians and Putin specifically, every decision that they make is to the benefit of Russia. Every decision, every consideration, those lenses that he looks at the world in every conversation is this long game about what is the best for Russia.
The long game might be to have economic relations with America.
That's right. Financially, it could be very beneficial to them, and that might be the best thing for Russia. But bringing the USSR, the large expansion of the Russian Empire. Those also might be goals of Vladimir Putin. And how do we reconcile these two things? Are they mutually exclusive or could they be complementary? They could be, but that's, thank God, why Trump is the man to do these negotiations.
Two segments. I want to talk about Iran next block, but I want to talk about Patton in both these blocks. First off, set the scene.
Yeah.
Here is Battle of the Bulge is approaching. We're in Europe. We got into that theater. You have George Patton, who's been studying Rommel and couldn't wait to finally take on the Nazis. He's finally there, but he needs something else. What does he need?
Yeah, he needs weather. He needs good weather. So D-Day happens. You know, we storm beaches. We climb cliffs. Rangers climbing Point de Hoc, Omaha Beach. You know, running up these sandy shores as machine gun fire is dropping young Americans that even lied to serve. Fast forward 3 months, we fought into Europe. We're moving and encroaching on Hitler's doorstep. Hitler, in a brilliant move, decides in his best efforts to divide our forces. And he is going to have one more major offensive. And this is November, December of 1944. And if he's successful, this would prolong the maybe even deny us victory in Europe if he's able to divide these forces. Patton needs to win this specific battle, and we have to have air support. But there's clouds, and he does the thing that only Patton will do, which is he goes to his chaplain and he says, I need a prayer. And he writes a beautiful prayer, which is now we know is Patton's prayer. He distributes it to 250,000 soldiers. 70% of the military currently has a belief in a greater God. Back then, it was around 80%. So 80% of the people in battle, and I'll argue that it was 100% because there's no atheists in a foxhole. Mm-hmm. So if you just surveyed everybody serving, they're like, yeah, I believe in a God, and I hope that he's going to be here. So he makes 250,000 of these prayers and distributes them to everybody on the ground, and everybody starts praying, and they pray for good weather. The weather breaks, Battle of the Bulge happens, and this major offensive from the Germans is either going to be successful and it's going to prolong the war, or we're successful in the Battle of the Bulge, and then we're going to be in Berlin.
So Alexandria Kershaw and Helen Patton are on your special. Here they are talking about this. Cut 57.
Imagine lying in a ditch that took you hours to dig due to the frozen ground. You're taking cover next to the body of a fallen soldier. You're low on ammo and have no reinforcements coming. And the enemy is firing at you. Your faith is really all that you have.
You have to believe in something. You have to believe in something bigger than yourself. You have to believe in some kind of force, something that's going to help you and your comrades endure the unendurable.
He wanted the soldiers to cultivate their faith so that they would never be alone.
And that was his granddaughter.
Yeah.
Helen Patton.
Yeah, the family's remarkable. You know, generals on both sides of the Patton family.
Yeah, the Tottens too.
That's right. And they, just a few months before that, in August, Patton, when talking with General Bradley, trying to decide about which army was going to do the next major offensive, they stopped and they prayed. And they didn't have enough resources to support both armies. But it was time and time again that you see faith being one of the main driving forces about how Patton's making decisions. Obviously, we were successful in Europe. Obviously, we stopped the Nazis. You know,
he wanted to go right to the Soviet Union.
Yes, he did.
He did not want to stop.
History has been very kind to things that he said. If you look back to post-April 1945, early as November, Patton was clearly calling for it. If we don't fight them now, we're going to be fighting them again.
Right.
And he was not wrong. Thing,
but he was. We made our alliance with him in order to get into Europe. Yeah. So to turn and shoot your friend or shoot your ally might have been trouble. But he was right. Remember, MacArthur wanted to take China. He's got, they're going to be a problem.
They're both right.
I know.
You know, we had to fight them four more times since then to include the Cold War.
Wow. Tim Kennedy's sticking around. More on this, a special that's on Fox Nation right now. It's called General Patton and the Prayer That Changed History. So Iran wants to avoid a war, you would think. But the stuff they're saying right now makes me think they don't. I'm just going to talk to Tim. You've been there, EFPs. Aren't they part of the – isn't that the IEDs on steroids? They killed so many of your guys.
Yeah.
That is Iranian built. How do we feel about this opportunity now to maybe get rid of the Ayatollah once and for all? Back in a moment.
Learning something new every day on The Brian Kilmeade Show.
Location, the lab. Quentin only has 24 hours to sell his car. Is that even possible? He goes to Carvana.com.
What is this, a movie trailer?
He ignores the doubters, enters his license plate. Wow, that's a great offer. The car is sold, but will Carvana pick it up in time for...
They'll literally pick it up tomorrow morning. Done with the dramatics?
Car selling in record time.
Save your time. Go to Carvana.com and sell your car today. Pickup fees may apply.
Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on The Brian Kilmeade Show.
The way I would characterize it is that this war could end immediately, and Israel's made that clear. It could end immediately if Hamas surrenders and gives up their weapons and demilitarizes and releases all the hostages, including the deceased ones. They did that, this conflict would end. That's been true from the very beginning. It's been true for months now. They're the ones that have chosen not to accept that offer.
IDF has gone in strong. At the same time, there's conversations going on with intensity over in Doha because they want to see if they can get the other 23 hostages out. So far, they've been able to kill, it's basically confirmed, Mohammed Sinwar, the second guy, after his brother Talid, and they wiped out a lot of their higher-ups. Tim Kennedy with us now, Army Ranger, sniper, Special Forces operator, co-founder of Save Our Allies. Tim is also host of a new Fox Nation special. It's available now, General Patton and the Prayer That Changed History. So, Tim, where do you think this is heading in Gaza? I mean, I look at these pictures. It looks like the most devastating, the other definition of devastation. There's a move now to possibly take a million to Libya. Isn't Libya just as bad almost?
Yeah, not almost. Definitely as bad. Yeah. It's apocalyptic when you look at the photos of what Gaza looks like right now. And nobody's to blame for this but Hamas.
And then Iran.
Yes, and Iran by proxy funding Hamas and enabling them both in training and equipment for the October 7th attack. Like this is what they wanted the whole entire time.
Wall Street Journal today said Sinwar publicly was saying that we have to stop Saudi Arabia and Israel to normalize relations, the Abraham Accords to continue, and this is what we have to do. He did this for the exact reason.
Yeah.
And it was successful in that way. It delayed everything. Delayed, but it didn't stop.
No, stability and security, free markets thrive. So does democracy and so do people. These are things that Iran does not want. They do not want stability. They do not want security in that region. They have flourished during chaos and anarchy, and they want to stoke the fires of war.
But Tim, don't you see how in many ways they're losing? They lost Syria, right? They Hezbollah is flat on its back. Hamas is on the run. The Houthi rebels are now, I guess, going to let our ships go through, but they have not stopped in many ways. And then they'll have their missile defense virtually destroyed by effective Iranian retaliation. This is as vulnerable as Iran has been. Do you see it the same way?
They are undoubtedly vulnerable, but they're also closer to a nuclear weapon than they've ever been. They have been digging their heels in, both under ideology and their kind of resolute, unwavering position about where they're going to be positioned in the Middle East. And I think now is the time for the entire region, mostly Muslim nations, should be condemning and clearly calling a spade, that Iran has been funding every single one of the Houthis, Hamas, and Hezbollah. These were all Iranian-funded proxy aggressors that were intentionally destabilizing the region, and call them out on it. And until that happens, until they're being held accountable by their neighbors, like what's going to be happening in the Middle East?
But they know it better than we know it. And they probably had those conversations when the president was going through the three Gulf states and met with the Syrian leader. Syria hates Iran. They destroyed their country, killed innocent people, propped up Assad, Shia. Alawites are a form of Shia. The Alawites, a minority, controlled the country. If you had a problem, they just killed you.
Yeah.
Barrel bombs, the most horrific way possible. I'm loving that. I would also, if I'm the U.S., say, hey, do you want relations with us? Kick out Russia. Wouldn't you want to see Russia out of the Middle East? That's their foothold.
Yeah. Russia and China have been playing a really strategic game where every time there has been instability, both in Africa and the Middle East, they're just sitting there, you know, biding their time so they can insert themselves. China coming in with like, hey, we can help rebuild this infrastructure. I'll build this port for you, or I'll build this new airport for you at this really discounted interest rate. But ultimately, it's China funded and China supported.
Yeah.
And then they have a foothold. We have to stop letting Iran get away with these opportunities, and China and Russia as the second order effect to capitalize on these moments.
Here is a little from your special. It's out now. It's called it's a General Patton, the Prayer That Changed History. Cut 54.
My grandfather wasn't the loose cannon that some people portray him as. In fact, his nickname that was given to him by the press was Blood and Guts. But he wanted to be known as Brains and Guts.
He constantly read military history, even as a young child. He loved hearing stories about it, and then would read it himself. Just the consummate military historian who wants to apply all that he has learned onto the battlefield.
And Tim, he felt like he was a man of destiny to begin with, yeah. And he knew he was going to be in battle, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's even quotes of him saying that he was former generals reborn.
Yes.
You know, he believed that he was born into this moment in time to save the world from tyranny. And boy, did he.
And Tim does a great job. He's hosting a brand new special, General Patton and the Prayer That Changed History. Go check it out on Fox Nation. Tim, thanks so much.
My
great
pleasure.
Talking to you.
Yeah, thanks.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With a message for everyone paying big wireless way too much. Please, for the love of everything good in this world, stop. With Mint, you can get premium wireless for just $15 a month. Of course, if you enjoy overpaying, no judgments, but that's weird. Okay, one judgment. Anyway, give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan, equivalent to $15 per month required. Intro rate first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See full terms at mintmobile.com.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here. Eli Lake in studio, columnist for the Free Press, contributor, editor, commentary magazine. He's got a hit podcast, too. Michael Goodwin is standing by. A lot happening. We just had a press conference. We'll bring back some highlights. Caroline Levitt just had a press conference because there's so much going on today. To recap the president's trip, yes. To give people a chance to ask questions, absolutely. The big, beautiful bill was able to get passed a key moment, got out of the budget committee with a lot of hurdles still remaining, will be in the rules, and then they'll put a floor vote, but there's some compromising that needs to take place just to get it there by the Memorial Day deadline for the House. And then the Senate is supposed to be going to work now, I hope, but they want to see what the House gives them. So we'll see where that goes from here. Also, there's going to be a big phone call with President Vladimir Putin of Russia. So that's going to be taking place a few hours. And then it's going to be followed up by, we think, but with a call to Zelensky and maybe a follow-up. My sense is this is not going to be a call to set up a meeting. I think this call has got to be substantive. And by the way, you know exactly where Russia stands. They sent 100 drones last night into Kyiv. If you are open to bringing this war to an end, you don't act more belligerent. You don't call for a one-on-one meeting on Thursday and then not show up. Michael Goodwin joins us now from the New York Post. Michael, welcome back.
Thank you, Brian.
Michael, we got I could have named seven other major stories, including the trade deals that the president says he's working on. We were supposed to get a few more announcements coming through. And, of course, the displacement possibly in Gaza, they're offering maybe 1 million people to go to Libya. So one hellhole to the next. I'm not too sure they're going to jump on that. But what are your thoughts, first off, on the president's trip?
Oh, look, I think it was a smashing success in terms of the purpose of the trip. Remember, Brian, beforehand, there were almost cautionary notes from the White House that this is essentially about business. This is a trip to drum up investments in America for America. And that was the purpose. Everything else was going to be secondary or not at all, meaning sort of the geopolitical situation. But I think it was – so in the sense of the business part of it, it was very successful. I mean, every country ponied up big numbers to invest in America, which, of course, the president rightly touts – as something unique to his presidency. I mean, he goes around the world looking to bring back money that will be invested in America, that will create jobs in America. So it really is an America first foreign trip. On the issue of, you know, geopolitical strategy, peace, et cetera, I do think there's a secondary impact here, and that is China. That China has really been trying to make inroads in the Mideast, and they've been working with Iran and trying to ingratiate themselves, as they do, with, you know, programs, the Belts and Roads and all of that kind of initiatives where they loan money. There's not a lot of need for money to be loaned in the Mideast, but there is this sense that China is looking to gain a foothold in an area where America has been the most powerful force. And so for the president to go there to make these military arrangements to be so well received by all of these monarchies, I think, is a pushback to China as well. So overall, big deal. I think we'll have to wait and see what happens with Iran and these nuclear talks. The president, in his invitation to the talks, the supreme leader, the Ayatollah, set a deadline of 2 months. Well, that was the middle of March. The deadline is here and gone. So is there going to be a deal or not? Because the president, I think, has laid out exactly the right outcome. The nuclear facilities must be destroyed. Either you do it or we will do it. I hope that's still the position. There's been a lot of talk since and all kinds of happy talk about good, productive meetings, but we don't have a real fix on where that's going. And then finally, I'll just say quickly, my column on Sunday was about the sense in Israel that it's being left out of the party in some way, that the president didn't go to Israel, of course, on this trip, but that the sense that he has been surprising Israel with a number of things lately. The talks on Iran, Israel did not know were going to happen until several days before they began. The president's team negotiated directly with Hamas for the release of the last living American hostage. And, of course, making these deals without, for example, with Saudi Arabia, without requiring normalization with Israel. The president pushed it but didn't demand it of Saudi Arabia. He did push it with Syria, and Syria, of all places, is now talking to Israel about joining the Abraham Accords. So there are big elements about this, and, of course, what's going on in Gaza. Israel is trying to finish Hamas, and, as you say, the president is talking about moving people out, and, you know, starvation issue has raised its head again. Are enough supplies getting in for the civilian population?
Well, now the supply,
really complicated stuff.
Yeah, the supplies are going to start going in again. The IDF had hit 160 terror targets. Looks like they killed the other guy in charge, Mohammed Sinwar, after his brother got killed. So Iran said this. Their chief negotiator said on Sunday that Tehran must give up all enrichment, nuclear fuel, and any deal over the fate of the country's nuclear program. And the response is essentially dismissed. They dismiss Witkoff's demand, accusing him of trying to negotiate a deal in public, and repeated that Iran's long-running argument that it will never give up its right to enrich under the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty. And they went over in detail how much money they've spent to get to this point. They will continue to spin centrifuges and continue to enrich uranium. The level is the only thing up for negotiation. And then you have the Iranian foreign minister essentially call America liars. So is that somebody that's trying to get a deal? Is that someone trying to avoid being attacked by two separate countries, Israel and America? As sooner or later, as reluctant as the president is, and he should be reluctant to use military force because there's always people that are going to die. But there's no way we could ever trust these guys. And if you allow them to enrich it all, we've wasted our time.
Well, that's right. I mean, you go back to the Obama treaty where, you know, you can't get the inspections that were agreed to. I mean, it's a useless
10-year
way of going.
Yeah.
It's a useless way of going about it. You'll never get any assurance that they're not working on a nuclear weapon. And they have said they will use it against Israel. So this is not just about Israel. It's about the entire Mideast. And you don't want to have a nuclear arms race. I mean, the Saudis want civilian use of nuclear, but that, of course, would give them the opportunity to essentially switch to militarization. So it is a dangerous time. The president, I think, wanted to give Iran a final choice, a final chance to make a deal and avoid it, but it certainly doesn't sound as if Iran has taken that choice, that they have decided that holding on to the nukes is going to be the hill they'll die on.
On Face the Nation, Robert Gates was on, former defense secretary for Democrats and Republicans. Cut 10.
The problem that I've had with a strike on the Iranian nuclear program is that it buys you a year or two. You're not going to be able to destroy, short of, as long as you're using conventional weapons, you cannot get at the very deeply buried parts of the Iranian nuclear program.
I think we might have the ordinances to do that, they say, especially if you collapse it, it could be considered destroyed. Question is, how many sites did they have that we didn't know about? We found one 3 weeks ago, and then the MEK, the outlaw group, the Iranian group that wants to overthrow the government, they're the ones who told us about Fordo and a couple others. So what don't we know?
Well, that's always a mystery. And again, that's why you can't trust them. That's why you cannot sign an agreement that leaves it up to them. I mean, that is how Israel has arrived at this point of wanting to bomb. And don't forget, the ordnance question aside, Israel basically stripped Iran of its air defense system. So they are effectively standing naked to air attacks. And I'm with you, Brian. I mean, it should be the last resort. But the mullahs have made it clear that they view their job is to wipe out everybody who stands in their way. I mean, they talk about Israel as the little Satan, America as the great Satan. And I know a lot of Americans are, you know, right now questioning whether we should get involved. But we should always remember this, that Israel's enemies are our enemies. It's not like we can just sacrifice Israel or let Israel do it on its own and then we'll be fine. No, no. These are the same people who see in their quest for universal dominance that America must fall. America must submit to this theocracy. That's what they are about. So it's not us doing Israel a favor. It's us doing ourselves a favor and guaranteeing peace for another generation.
All right. There's so much going on, too. Your quick reaction to Joe Biden's cancer diagnosis looks like it's in his bones. And then people are just wondering, as they look at his past medical tests, why are there no PSA test results for every other president there is? Why was there none for him? Did he have the worst doctors, or did he have this before he got the job as president?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think it really is a shocking development, Brian, that it seems to be so far along and we've never heard of it before. He got clean bill of health every time. I mean, either the doctors are ignorant or they're liars.
I want you to hear what Dr. Zeke Emanuel said. Cut 43.
He did not develop it in the last 100, 200 days. He had it while he was president. He probably had it at the start of his presidency in 2021. Yes, that I don't think there's any disagreement about that.
If your doctor to a president of the United States that is a male, that is an older man, would this not be one of the first tests that you would conduct as a White House doctor?
If you're a White House doctor in this situation, I think you would certainly discuss it with the president and talk about the pros and cons. I think if you then ask, well, if President Biden says, well, if I'm your father, which patients often do, you know, what would you recommend? I think the fact is that most White House doctors would recommend getting the test. And again, the evidence is, look at President Obama, President Bush, younger than President Biden, and they both got the test. There was some criticism when President Obama got the test that he got it too young and things. But I think in this case, if especially for the president thinking that he's going to live another decade, you would recommend to him to get the test.
What's going on, real quick, Michael?
Yeah, look, I think if you put this in the context, Brian, of the interview being made public, snippets of it, you just get this sense of a massive cover-up in the Biden White House, his health, right? Anything to do that might cast doubt on the fact that he's anything other than a vigorous, healthy man. He seems to be very unhealthy in at least two main ways now, and there's no reason to think this just happened suddenly. So it does call into question his entire presidency. Who was making the decisions? Who used the auto pen? All of these, I think, are legitimate questions.
I think Jill and Hunter are running the country, and that's what I think is happening. And these guys just covered for it, Donilon and all these guys, and his cabinet secretaries, they were quick to say the 25th Amendment on Trump because they didn't like his decisions, but they weren't going to do the 25th Amendment for the good of the country here. Are you kidding me? He couldn't think. He couldn't have meetings. His policies were terrible. He was invisible. Couldn't work more than 3 days. They can't get him on the phone. If that isn't something where you do an interview and say, look, I can't serve anymore because I think I'm serving for an invisible president. Nobody had the wherewithal to do that. Right. Michael, it's just crazy. Michael, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Brian. Thank you.
All right.
You.
Listen, bottom of the hour, Eli Lake. Next year calls 1-866-408-7669.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
This episode is brought to you by LifeLock. Not everyone is careful with your personal information, which might explain why there's a victim of identity theft every 5 seconds in the U.S. Fortunately, there's LifeLock. LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points a second for threats to your identity. If your identity is stolen, a U.S.-based restoration specialist will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Save up to 40% your first year by visiting LifeLock.com/podcast. Terms apply.
fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
According to a new tell-all book, Biden's inner circle revealed that they were worried the president would need a wheelchair in his second term, especially after they were all done stabbing him in the back.
Yeah, I missed SNL this week. Was it funny, Allison? Did we hear it?
You know, they did the Weekend Update where they had to read each other's jokes. And that was very funny, but it doesn't work as well for radio.
Right. Obviously. The other thing is, it was a terrible season, I thought. They were just, really not strong. I guess they're supposed to celebrate 50 years. But, I like it because, like, a lot of times it was like the Tonight Show. It used to be a time when you really recalibrated on major events and SNL would do the week. But there's no next Adam Sandler there that I could tell. But let's talk about the Biden situation. Obviously, the cancer is a bit of a mystery. Not good, regardless. I'm not saying he made that up. I'm sure that's real. Nobody would ever make that up. But just the idea of him coming out with this information now after he tried his rehab tour and it failed. Again, just like all his meetings with national anchors and help to save his candidacy failed. Then he comes out, does The View and BBC. That was terrible. And now they're coming out with all these stories and books about how he was an invisible president, how he was cognitively not there. And then the release of the Heard tapes. Listen to how confused this guy was. Cut 24.
What's happened in the meantime is that and Trump gets elected in November of 2016. All right. So, what about 2017 here?
That's when you left office, January of 2017.
Yeah. Okay. But that's when Trump gets sworn in.
Right. Right. Correct.
Okay. Yeah.
Oh, my God. What the hell? Are you kidding me? I mean, doesn't understand you win in 2016, you get sworn in 2017. He doesn't understand that that's when he leaves office? That wouldn't stand out to you that year? First time he's out of office in his life since he's been 28 years old? He doesn't have an official job?
No, I know. Like, thinking about that, like, listening to him, like, well, I don't necessarily remember the year, but you were in office. You were the vice president. You were leaving. Or, like, wait, was I vice president then? Like, these are things that should sort of be like major markers.
But it threw
him.
Why do I write 2017? I don't know. That's the day you left. You don't leave the day you lose an election. Cut 25.
Bo knew how much I adored him. And this sounds so. Everybody knew how close we were. There was not anybody in the world who wondered whether or not. Anyway. And so.
Sir, I'm wondering if this is a good time to take a break.
Let me just keep going.
So you see what they're saying? Can I take a break? Because it's not the question. Because I read this on the transcripts. He'd ask a question. He'd be asked a question. And he would just start saying things. He'd get on a word, go on that, forget what he was talking about. And that's why he says, why don't you take a break? Because obviously he couldn't even have the energy to finish his sentence.
Or his brain wasn't there to answer the question.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
The other way didn't really work. I mean, planting democracy in the Middle East was really, I mean, they gave a lot of reasons why we went into Iraq, but that was really what, they couldn't say it all the time, but Thomas Friedman would say it for them. We need to plant a democracy in the heart of the Arab world. And it didn't work because, you know what, you got to get rid of the religion. That's not going to happen in our lifetimes before you can get to democracy. They don't care about the same things. Biden would not talk to MBS after he cut off the guy's head. And then 6 months later, when we needed Saudi Arabia, he went over there and fist bumped him.
So Bill Maher just, I think, doing a valuable show. He gave a salute to the president for a lot of his approaches with the Gulf states. Some people didn't like it. I liked it. I see much more upside than downside. And he's pointing that out in that monologue. Eli Lake is with us. He's got his podcast, Breaking History. He also has a columnist for the Free Press, which I listen to and read. He's a contributor editor at Commentary as well. Eli, in studio. Great to see you.
Great to see you. Thanks for having me.
What do you think would, it's a big picture question, what Bill Maher was talking about? He's going back to the Iraq War and building democracy. And he says, Trump goes over there and goes, you handle your own society. Let's have a economic relationship. You all right with that?
I have two thoughts on it. I don't think it should be an either or. Meaning, I think if your point is don't do regime change wars where you come in and impose a huge amount of Western values and culture on a country that doesn't share those values, that's 100% right. Anybody would, I think, agree with that at this point. However, if you look at the actions, particularly in the beginning of this second Trump administration, they zeroed out funding for the National Endowment for Democracy. Those are boutique grants. In the grand scheme of things, it's not a lot of money. And that is to people who are in these societies who share our values. So I look
at it. Do you think that was is that a group that was working?
I believe that there are – I look at it like this. If they're taking, let's say, 150 bets, if 15 of those bets turn out, then it's worth it. So – it's not America finding stooges. People come to those organizations like the International Republican Institute or, you know, all these things that were used to be bipartisan. They were very Reagan was a huge supporter of this stuff. To me, that's not cultural imperialism. To me, that's America, you know, kind of being a beacon to the world without having doesn't mean you have to invade, doesn't mean you have to use military force. It doesn't mean a lot of things. You're gonna make, you know, in the Cold War, we made deals with dictators all the time, and we had to. Obviously, World War II, we aligned with Stalin against Hitler. That happens, and that's normal. But there's this other side of the U.S. government that quietly, steadily will, you know, sort of be there for other people in places like Iran or Saudi Arabia who are pushing their own struggle for freedom. To me, that's different than the other stuff. So I don't think it's an all or nothing.
So
but I agree with part up to a point of what Trump is saying.
But I will say this. We also are in a mini Cold War now with China. We got to be there first. And that means if you have an imperfect country with an imperfect democracy, if you are – or no democracy.
Sure.
If we feel as though we can trust the alliance. So they're buying military.
Yep.
And they're buying AI. And they're buying chips.
Yep.
And they got to make sure that they're not going to go sell it to China. Now, China's playing hardball with us. Do you see they went up to South Korea and they said, don't you sell chips to America?
I did see that.
And rare earth to America? So they're going to try to use leverage on a so-called democracy, which is our ally in South Korea, who's complaining about their belligerence in the South China Sea. They think they can strong-arm South Korea. We have to step up there.
Can I counter? Like, I agree. We're going to have to make alliances with certain countries when we can that are not perfect, like Vietnam, when you're talking about China and countering China. On the other hand, if there are Chinese citizens brave enough to seek our assistance because they want the same freedoms that we have, I don't understand why we can't have an organization that quietly tries to help them.
Right. I think that people have a hard time because a lot of those international organizations – we're tending to be anti-American. I'll give you an example.
Sure.
Governor Pataki said that the group that was working for democracy in the Ukraine wouldn't even get back to him. He's trying to get aid to them. These guys were pushing an agenda. They thought they were better than America.
Great point. But so here's my counter to that. Absolutely right. Reform, don't destroy. So that's why, you know, bring in your own people. By the way, there are people on the board of the National Endowment for Democracy, like Elise Stefanik, that absolutely have the right intentions and exactly what to do. The problem is, I think sometimes it's conflated with the more like nefarious international NGO complex. Some of that money comes from the US, some of it comes from the UN, some of it comes from George Soros. And that stuff, yeah, absolutely. That's not about promoting democracy. That's important. That's promoting environmental justice and a whole bunch of things that I agree with. But I just think that you're throwing out a little bit of the baby with the bathwater. I know that I'm not that's not a popular opinion, but that's
with
my
the Gulf
view.
States, those three, how much do they view Iran as a threat?
I think they absolutely view Iran as a threat.
So that's a commonality with Israel.
Yes. However, I would say this: they are also looking at our politics and the inconstancy and the changes in policies between administrations, from Obama to Trump to Biden back to Trump. And they, I think that there is a concern that they're less willing to go in all in with us because they're wary that, okay, well, Trump's great on this, but what happens if the next guy, the next president's like, I don't know, AOC or some Democrat who will go back to, you know, shunning Saudi Arabia for human rights violations and trying to make a terrible deal with Iran.
Right.
So I do think that that's not Trump's fault, by the way.
The world's over if AOC wins. So let's,
Okay, fair enough.
We're both going to Ireland with Rosie O'Donnell.
But you know what I'm saying? I just look at it like that. Like, I think that there's a little bit of concern, so they want to cover their bets.
So let's talk about Iran.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about this nuclear program. You see that their foreign minister came out and said, we're never going to stop enriching. We're never going to stop spinning centrifuges. And we, America and the Grand Ayatollah over the weekend said, America is a bunch of liars. Fantastic. Here's what Robert Gates said about these talks on Face the Nation, Cut 9.
The Middle East may be one place where there are some real opportunities and possibilities. It's a place to do business for China, for the United States, for everybody else. The actions of Israel post the October 7th massacre by Hamas has really changed the strategic equation in the Middle East, because Iran has been dramatically weakened. Iran's in a very weak place now, and if there is an opportunity to do a deal on nuclear, this is it.
It's it. But what has to exist in that deal for Eli Lake to sign off on it?
There's got to be zero enrichment. There's got to be an understanding that with your newfound wealth, you're not going to rebuild your proxy terrorist network. And I mean, if it was up to me, if I was the king of the world, I would also have a clause that you have to have a referendum of the Iranian people on the legitimacy of the supreme leader. I know that's not in the cards.
He's going to die soon anyway.
I know, but then, like, I don't want another lunatic to replace him. I don't like the system, and I don't think the Iranian people like the system. So the Iranians are posturing right now, and what they're counting on is, I think, to string out the negotiations and try to rebuild their air defenses in the process and try to get into a better strategic situation. And I think they're counting on a kind of over-the-top paranoid hysteria from some voices in the U.S. on both the left and the right that are going to say anything you do militarily against Iran is the start of World War III. So in my view, that is a ploy, because you want the Iranians to think, all right, if you don't make a deal soon, bombs away. That's what you want the Iranians to think. Obviously, everybody would rather have this work out through a deal. Gates is absolutely right. But if it doesn't work out, we still have to be prepared. This is the opportunity to take it out. They can't use Hezbollah and Hamas the way they could before. They don't have those air defense systems. Now's the time to do it. And I think Israel is going to have to make a choice in a couple months. If Trump, you know, doesn't commit, they might have to do it themselves. And I do think they have more capabilities than we kind of than sometimes let on in the public discourse.
Well, I hope, number one, they have to.
Yes,
I mean, absolutely. They've already said this for preservation. And my analogy was, they took out Syria on their own. George W. Bush said no.
Yep.
They bunked, and then they took out in the 1980s. Reagan told them no. Yep. And he took out Iraq, right?
Yeah.
So why would now at this point, when they're it's not a theory, their existence is at stake. And how about the Wall Street Journal report today that said that Sinwar publicly was saying that we have to stop Saudi Arabia from normalizing relations with Israel? That's why October 7th happened. They saw it just around. They saw it just around the corner.
Yeah.
So this is exactly it. They have to stop progress. And who is behind all that? It is Iran. I know nothing's simple in the Middle East, especially, but the vulnerability, the way they've acted since, the Hamas and Hezbollah being flat on their backs right now. What would be your next step in Gaza?
I think in Gaza, if there is a way to do it, Israel or America or some other third party has to align with the Gazans, who are risking their lives and the lives of their families, to stand up. This has now been for a few months, and say, we don't want Hamas here anymore. That is the avenue to end the war, because the senior leadership is pretty much decimated at this point. And if you don't want another generation of Hamas leaders to rise up, you have to come up with some sort of arrangement or agreement with these other factors in Gaza who are like, you've led us to ruin. So I think there has to be some sort of – you got to view those people as the most important allies for Israel, even though – I mean, if you ask them, they probably don't like Israel very much. But the point is that they're saying this was a disaster. We don't want Hamas to sort of use us as pawns anymore. And to me, that's the way out. You know, I'm glad that they're opening the border to a certain extent. The U.S. is going to try to distribute food to the people, not to Hamas. That's good in the sense that we don't want to starve civilians. What you want to do is you want to deprive Hamas of the leverage of controlling the food and everything like that.
And this is what they do. They put their leaders next to hospitals.
Yep.
And the Israel is done letting those leaders live.
Absolutely.
And now they're going into land and they're holding it. And they're blowing up all these tunnels, and they put, I guess, 160 targets. But the other thing is, with them going in and talking to people, the Palestinians, if they go in and they hold land, at the same time they have talks about with the hostages, and the deal on the table is 2 months ceasefire for 10 hostages. Would you do that?
It's a very hard call. I think I probably would because it's so important
to
the Israelis.
It's only 22 left.
But as I said, at this point, Brian, the most important thing, you mentioned the clear and hold and build strategy, which is what Petraeus did in Iraq when we turned it around. Who's going to be that local mayor? It's got to be one of those guys who was like brave enough to protest.
You got to identify him.
Yeah. You got to identify. And by the way, they've identified themselves now. So it's not like you're going in there and you're plucking people out of obscurity.
But you got to protect them now.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. That's your most important strategic asset.
And what
Hamas
has been doing with the aid in the past, this is what frustrated the Israelis especially, is taking the aid and selling it to the people.
Oh, it's horrible.
It's crazy.
I know.
And then they find that the UN is part of it. UNRWA.
The UN is so utterly corrupt at this point. It should be the scandal of the whole war. And the fact that there's still like lots of Americans and lots of influencers in the United States that take the UN seriously is a scandal in and of itself. They have discredited themselves. I'm with you 100% on that.
All right. Eli Lake, Breaking History, the name of your podcast.
The Free Press. But I just want to plug really quick. The Free Press has last week an amazing, really detailed investigation into Qatar and Qatar's kind of influence operations throughout America, not just in Washington, but universities, law firms, et cetera. I highly recommend it by my colleagues, Jay Solomon and Franny Black.
Back in a moment.
Giving you everything you need to know. You're with Brian Kilmeade. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
At this point in time, you know, around a month or so after left the vice presidency, were you still in the process of going through your stuff at CBR to see what was packed where and where everything was?
Well, I don't specifically remember, but I can't imagine not. They just drop all these boxes in a library and boxes and then there's a hallway in the back of the garage, pull out of stuff and the garage itself, boxes piled up, and my problem was, where the hell is all this stuff going?
So he is all over the place. He does not hold a thought. They were unbelievably polite during the Robert Hur investigation to him. He did it on October 7th. What kind of terrible judgment is that? Israel's under the worst attack, certainly in his lifetime, or certainly in his presidency. We don't know the scope of it. And he's like, no, I'll still do the interview. Are you crazy? Eli Lake is with us still from the Free Press. And Breaking History is his podcast. So, Eli, what's your reaction as you listen to these tapes?
Well, I would say the most important thing to remember is what the spin was after the Hur report comes out a few months later. Do you remember that? Kamala Harris took the lead and impugned the character of Robert Hur, who,
absolutely,
if anything, was mild compared to what the tapes were. I mean, he was charitable in a way.
Absolutely.
And, like, their whole Democratic spin machine went into a whole series, like it was a bunch of news cycles in a row about how Robert Hur has politicized his job as a special counsel, and this is a Republican setup, and it was all about Hur. They were trying to, you know, hide the ball. And if you talk about the media complicity in this, it's the fact that the media, I think, went along with that stuff as well. It's, you can find journalists, particularly Jake Tapper's co-author, Alex Thompson, like he did write brave stories at the time, and he was denounced by his peers. The problem was the larger, like, legacy media herd went with so much of the White House spin on it, And that kind of enabled it. So kind of like, you know, that's the thing. And I do think it was the whole thing is bad judgment.
You know what I did? I read the transcript, and they've been changed. They were changed.
Oh, wow.
But there was, but by the way.
Good for you.
But I read the transcript. The transcript were damning. They were really damning. And he said, sir, that's a great story. Maybe some other time. Can we get back to my question? I understand. By this and by this. It just all over the place. It was frustrating to read.
Yeah.
And then they tried to let him bail out a couple of times. You want to take a break, right? Oh, no, I'm fine, which is not true. Is he still lying about his medical condition? We get this devastating news about his prostate cancer. Listen to Zeke Emanuel, Dr. Zeke Emanuel, Rahm Emanuel, obviously a Democrat, cut 42.
But this is, it is also aggressive. When we talk about aggressive, part of what we mean is that Gleason score, that score is from it's a 2 up to 10. And he's at a 9. And that means that the cancer doesn't look normal. It looks very abnormal, which is probably why it's in the bone. And it has been around for a very long time in President Biden years. Exactly how many, we don't know, obviously. And it is a little surprising to many of us oncologists that he wasn't diagnosed earlier.
And it makes one question. Was he diagnosed earlier? You know, why
how much can you believe from Team Biden at this point?
Nothing.
Right. I mean, I assume he was.
And doesn't he get maximum sympathy at a time in which his whole legacy is falling apart with his book out tomorrow, the Her tapes out today?
I think it's a disaster for him. It's a disaster for his legacy. But we both know the seeds for this were planted long ago. If you want to give him a mulligan in 2020 for running, even though maybe even then he was not didn't have the acuity to be the president, fine. But when they decided after the midterms that he was going to run for a second term, knowing what they knew in those first 2 years, that's where he burned his legacy to ashes.
But the thing is, Eli, I don't give him a pass because I don't forget. Maybe he is not mentally well enough to know he's not mentally well. Between his family, maybe they're too close. But when Chris Coons goes to visit you, and you, Chris Coons, you know that he couldn't hold a thought.
Yeah.
You know, all these people go to see him and they go, oh my God, who's running the country? Eli, we're going to check out the Free Press and check out
all
your
right.
podcast.
Thank you so much.
Breaking History. Brian Kilmeade Show. So much to talk about.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade here. Thanks so much for listening this hour. Sean Davis is going to be with us, CEO and co-founder of The Federalist, former economic and policy advisor to Governor Rick Perry. Trey Gowdy is standing by. I'm going to buy him a little bit of time because he was out last night hosting his show. And I know he goes out and parties after that show. And then they got cast parties and then post parties. So you know what it's like with those big budget shows on Sunday night. And thanks, everyone, for watching One Nation after Trey Gowdy. So I appreciate that. And before we get to Trey, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
It is interesting to note that President Trump's, President Obama's, and President Bush II, in their most recent physicals, in their terms of office, did comment on their PSA levels. In the case of President Biden, it was not.
In tatters, as Joe Biden's cancer announcement takes center stage, we look back at his 4 years as president and the scandal regarding his incapacity. It's flat out poisoning almost all who conspired with him to cover it up. We got the tapes.
Number two.
Walmart is, in fact, they are going to, they, as you describe it, eat some of the tariffs that just as they did in 18, 19, and 20.
Trade, Walmart, and the big, beautiful bill. We look at the economic and the trade deals with the major powers on deck. The beautiful bill gets chopped up, but survives, and Walmart gets some backlash. We'll discuss it.
Number one.
Most importantly, that's why I came here. I didn't come here to say, gee, you guys are rich and you have a lot of oil. You know, they have a lot of money, and I want them to spend the money in the United States. And we set records. There's never been a trip like this by any president or anybody.
Right. That's a president on his game, talking quickly, directly, off the cuff. The president we have for the previous 4 years, it's even worse than we could have imagined. Joining us now to discuss is Trey Gowdy, former chairman of the House Oversight Committee and host of Sunday Night in America with Trey Gowdy. Trey, how big are those post-show parties that I keep hearing about in South Carolina? Like, when do you know when to cut it off?
You
You know what I did after my show? I went and watched women's college softball. That's my idea.
Oh, you did?
Of partying.
Yeah. Oh, so you didn't watch One Nation. That hurts my feelings.
No, of course I watch One Nation, but I've got you on my computer and I got softball on my television in my office.
Got it.
I can tell you who you had on last night, and I watched your greatest, fastest monologue in the history of mankind.
I'm working on graphics for that. Right. Sunday at 9, of course, we would
watch
you.
Thank you so much, Brian. I mean, have you ever thought about maybe taking an hour off?
No,
you are a workaholic.
No, it's kind of fun. But, Trey, I need your expertise. First off, I know you know how the making of legislation. What did you think about the fact that we had three who just voted not to present and get it through committee? The big, beautiful bill has got some miles left, don't we? And negotiations yet.
Yeah, I mean, every time I think that Mike Johnson can't thread the needle, he does it. Donald Trump, I think it was Kevin McCarthy a couple of weeks ago that said President Trump is having to be the president and the Speaker of the House. He can get people's attention like no one else in politics. It's just these prima donnas, and I serve with them too. They just crave attention, and the way to get attention is like the bad kid in kindergarten class. That's who gets the attention. The ones that say, "Well, it's not quite perfect enough." You know what? The president missed his opportunities his first term because legislators thought that, you know, perfect was what we should get and not good enough. Think about. You would not have a majority in the House if it weren't for California and New York Democrats. Think about that.
Exactly.
Lee Zeldin overperforming is probably why you have a majority, to be honest about it. So salt matters to them, even though it doesn't matter to folks in the Deep South. President Trump and Mike Johnson, in that order, I think, deserve a lot of credit because the margin is so tight.
I will say this. I understand what Chip Roy is saying, though. I mean, we're not cutting spending like we should. And the president said flat out, I'm not cutting entitlements, which takes two-thirds of all spending off the table. And Chip Roy, Andrew Clyde, Josh Brasheen, and Congressman Ralph Norman are the four that just said, I'm not ready yet. Now, the New York guys and women are, and the blue state guys saying, I need some to be able to write off my state taxes. And their argument, Trey, is, we pay more to the government, so we want to get some more of it back. But in South Carolina, you must be like, well, what's that like? High state taxes. I don't even know what you – why should I pay the price for that? And that's what they're saying in Texas too. But at some point, there's got to be a compromise. From you could always read what is real or not. You know, there's no Matt Gaetz who is – I could not figure out what he was doing. Do you believe that they're just trying to get the best deal possible, but they are going to come together and get this done by Memorial Day? Because nothing's changing after Memorial Day.
They have to. They don't have a choice. I mean, they will never be trusted to govern again. Right now, you have all three gears of government. If you blow it, history says you're going to lose the midterms. So you really have 2 years. You might possibly have four, but this is your chance, or else taxes are going up on everyone. And I'll say this about, you know, the purists. Okay, great. Zero out discretionary spending. Zero it out, which is absurd. But even if you did, you'd still have a deficit because the leader of the party says entitlements are off the table. So when President Trump says, I'm not touching Social Security, Medicare, you can't do anything about interest on the debt, when that's off the table, then all that's left is discretionary spending. And look, I had somebody on my show last night, domestic violence. I mean, who thinks that we all like spend less money keeping women alive? But that's being cut. And until Republicans are honest about entitlement or mandatory spending, which politically is suicide, so then that gets back to actually, this is why I'll never run for office again, the voters have to say yes. Maybe I need to work six more months, or maybe I need to pay more into Medicare. Until that happens, until you reform the entitlements, then the rest of this is just fluff, Brian.
I know. I hear you. You know, my hunch is, and I know it's the school of thought for Republicans, for conservatives, and I do think there's merit in it besides the politics. If you could just give people back more of their money, cut the red tape, make people give an opportunity, you keep interest rates reasonable, and you have energy costs low, the American people will start being more productive. And right there, the growth can't be, it's hard to quantify with hard numbers. But I will say this. When you looked at the CBO numbers, and now we find out that most of the people that make up the CBO, the supposedly nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office that projects what bills will cost, do you see partisanship in that? I mean, how often are they inaccurate and are never called out about it, but they really can kill or make legislation?
Yeah, I'll make your head spin. There's something called static analysis and dynamic analysis. So, I mean, look, I went to law school for a reason. I let other people explain the numbers to me. But yes, there's politics involved. If you give people more of their money back, then you're going to, yes, you're going to have less revenue possibly coming in. But I had Jason Smith on a couple of weeks ago, chair of Ways and Means. He says revenue is a percentage of our gross domestic output is actually higher than it's been. We don't have a revenue issue.
Yeah.
And the other thing I would ask, Brian, is if 37 or 38% is not enough, I mean, you work really hard. I started off by talking about how hard you work. 38%? God only asked for 10%.
Right.
38% and you live in New York or
state,
New Jersey?
Then factor in the state taxes. So you're given, so how much more of your money do you have to give away for people to be happy? You know, so
and the people you're giving it to aren't grateful for it, and most of them want more of it.
Right. And it hasn't been fully, no one's really pushed back hard on that. But this is what we found out. The Council on Economic Advisors study on the impact of the taxes on this bill, roughly how it's made up right now. They say the short-term effects of Trump's cuts over the next 4 years, from 9.9% to 14.9% higher investment. So it's going to go up 5. And to GDP, they think it'll go from 4.5 to 5.5. They project when it comes to full-time equivalent jobs saved or created, 6.6 to 7.4 million. These are projections that the obviously the Trump people embrace. So it's going to be a fascinating sprint to Memorial Day, then see what the Senate does, and then see what passes. And we'll see where we go from here. When you look at the president's trip overseas, when he comes back with these trillions, do you have any problem with the fact that he didn't go to Israel after?
You know, I had two folks on last night, and I asked that very question. So your mind and my mind work the same way. And they're subject matter experts, and they were not concerned about it because the president's been really, really good to Israel. They actually added something I had not thought of. So Russia's economy actually is doing better than ours right now. They're growing at a higher clip than ours. So he went to talk to the oil producers because that's what Russia is making its money off of, which is energy. I'd never thought about that before. Let's go talk to the other energy producers to put more pressure on Russia. If that was the subplot, then that was genius. I don't think anybody can question his commitment to Israel. At first, I would have liked to have seen him touch down in Tel Aviv and just, you know, show some solidarity with the Israeli people. But in hindsight, you know, I've had plenty of friends at work in his administration right now that said, look, Trey, he talks to Netanyahu all the time. You don't need to worry about the fact he didn't stop in Tel Aviv. So I stopped worrying about it.
I hear you. But they say the interest rates right now in Russia, 20%. I'm pretty sure you're not taking out a home loan on that. And when it comes to inflation, it's at 10%. And most of their economy is making weapons. So my feeling is with this call today with Vladimir Putin, how does he tell 45% of his economy to stop making weapons? I mean, he's going to not stop on a dime, but it's not going to be at this rate. And evidently, he's got a bunch of war veterans who have lost their minds from the intensity of the pitched battle that they're in, roaming around Russia. So he's going to have a lot more. So this guy's got problems with the war ending and with the war continuing, but we'll see where it goes. The other thing I want to tap into is to your legal mind, the Aliens Enemies Act. So from 1794, it doesn't seem as though this president will be able to apply that to get these illegal immigrant criminals out of the country. What's plan B then?
He shouldn't have to rely on an act that's older than Lindsey Graham. Congress should amend that. I mean, invasion meant something different in the late 1700s than it means now. I mean, they didn't have gangs and cartels. They may have had pirates, but they didn't have gangs and cartels. So my question is, why is Congress asking him to use the Alien Enemies Act? Why not update it and say invasion includes designated gangs, drug cartels, he should not be using an act that is 200 plus years old. That's my response to it. Congress, you ought to be able to do more than one thing at a time and power him with some modicum of due process, some modicum. That's what the Supreme Court said. It doesn't have to be a lot. It just has to be something, some due process, and then you can deport them. But he shouldn't be relying on an act that old. He shouldn't have to.
All right. So that's interesting. So in other words, if they put together an act on, you know, expeditious removal, expedited removal. So they get their moment. They get their gavel. They get in front of a judge or something like that. They get some type of act that's got to pass. Is it going to pass on a simple majority or does he need 60 votes?
I would include it in reconciliation and get it over the finish line. And I would say you're going to make – so what happens is people claim refugee or asylum status. Those are your two arguments. But you know what? The longer you stay incarcerated, the less you want to wait for your court date. So where we get in trouble is we release them out into the world. Then we got to go find them again somewhere in the U.S., with a court date 2 years in the future, you can't find them. They're committing more crimes, and you have sanctuary cities. Number one, cut off sanctuary cities. Number two, quicker hearings. Number three, get rid of the fraud and the refugee and asylum programs. And he's already closed the border. He deserves tremendous credit for closing the border. Now we got to deal with what's here, not just border crossers, but also visa overstayers. But you've got to get people to court quicker, Brian. You can't leave them out there for 2 years.
Well, I know. I hear you. And that's why they got to be on a special track. And then I never thought about putting the legislation. Could be in the Big Beautiful Bill, right?
Yes.
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah, just put it. So write the legislation, put it in this bill, pass it on reconciliation. And I don't know what. How did Bill Clinton pull out 350,000? He had expedited removal. What were those parameters?
Well, look, it's not beyond a reasonable doubt. So when people say you're a trial, it's not a trial like you and I think about, like what Sean Combs is going. It's a hearing, literally. You can use hearsay. You can switch the burden of proof. I mean, the burden of proof ought to be on the person claiming. It ought to be more than just I am in fear for my life. You got to be able to just more than learn the English for that. So make them prove that and add to it no criminal history where you're coming from, or if you commit any offense in addition to crossing the border, you're ineligible for refugee or asylum status. I'm sorry, you're going back home. If you commit something, say it's a felony or say it's a misdemeanor with violence, it is so easy to do. It's just honestly, Brian, both sides benefit from the immigration fight, which is why there's been no resolution of it.
See, I think if you could seal the border, I think there's so many Republicans. We are actually seeding the ground to get legitimate immigration reform, maybe in the president's last year. I always said until the border sealed, they can't talk about it. But now there's so many other areas in which we agree need to be done. For example, you marry someone from Argentina. It takes so long and costs so much money in order for them to become citizens. Getting our first round draft picks to stay. So I just think that there's so many things. By sealing the border, it could solve a lot of problems. Trey, unfortunately, I'm out of time to solve any more problems. But listen, America, if you listen, Speaker Johnson, if you're listening, put that in the legislation. Trey, thanks so much.
Thank you, Brian. Take care of yourself.
And Sunday's at 9 o'clock. Watch his show. Don't move.
Increasing your intelligence quotient.
What the hell did you just say?
It's Brian Kilmeade. Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
In what counts as good news in 2025, the Menendez brothers have been resentenced for the 1989 murder of their parents after the judge said he did not believe the brothers posed a risk if released, unless someone adopts them.
Oh. Okay, there you go. That's pretty funny. So that was they switched parts on Weekend Update. Those two are coming back, but I mean for the rest of the time, I don't know what they're gonna do. Don't you think that Lorne Michaels walks away? Do you know they're talking about taking over?
What?
Who teams with Amy Poehler?
Tina Fey.
Tina Fey, they say, might be the next Lorne Michaels.
Well, you know who
over.
You should have asked about that intel would have been Zarna last week, because she opens for Amy and Tina. right. on the road.
But would you ever want to take over for Lorne Michaels?
No.
Wouldn't that be the worst?
But to be fair, right when they started the five here, they said it's just going to be a filler. You never want to take over for the person who was ahead of it that did so well. And they,
well, you know, for the reason why the five, because the reason why the five did well, it was so different from the single host they replaced.
Yes.
So let's do something totally different with unknowns. We don't have to worry about it. Now it's the number one show on all of television.
So maybe she'd excel and do even better.
Possibly.
Maybe.
Hey, a quick announcement. Coming up in Dayton, WHIO listeners, June 21st, I'm going to be at the History of Liberty and Laugh with Fox Nation on stage. Go to BrianKilmeade.com. Got some VIP tickets left. August 23rd, Dallas, Texas, the Winspear Opera House. So go to BrianKilmeade.com. And Richmond, Virginia, September 27th. Well, I hope to see everybody out there. It's good. These are great radio markets. That's my chance to see you guys in person.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
He did not develop it in the last 100, 200 days. He had it while he was president. He probably had it at the start of his presidency in 2021. Yes, that I don't think there's any disagreement about that.
If you're doctor to a president of the United States that is a male, that is an older man, would this not be one of the first tests that you would conduct as a White House doctor?
If you're a White House doctor in this situation, I think you would certainly discuss it with the president and talk about the pros and cons. I think if you then ask, well, if President Biden says, well, if I'm your father, which patients often do, you know, what would you recommend? I think the fact is that most White House doctors would recommend getting the test. And again, the evidence is, look at President Obama, President Bush, younger than President Biden, and they both tests. There was some criticism when President Obama got the test that he got it too young and things. But I think in this case, if especially for the president thinking that he's going to live another decade, you would recommend to him to get the test.
Dr. Zeke Emanuel talking on MSNBC of all places. Now they want to dive into the health of Joe Biden. Sean Davis is CEO and co-founder of the Federalist, former economic policy advisor to Governor Rick Perry. Sean, are you amazed at the darkness? And now they want to find out when the former president got his cancer?
It's kind of amazing, especially in the midst of this news cycle where everyone pretends like we didn't know what was going on with his mental state for 5 years. And in the middle of that, they drop, oh, yeah, he had cancer. But they try to tell us, yeah, we literally just found out on Friday. Which, you know, I guess anything's possible, but I'm pretty skeptical just given the way that disease progresses.
Obviously, wish him the best. I'm sure they didn't make it up. It's horrible. It's on to the bone. But there's therapies, 5 to 7 years, they say. Just looking at him, I'm surprised he lasted his presidency. He does not look healthy, never has. But I guess I was the only one to understand that. Now everyone's shocked that he was failing the way he did. The Robert Hur tapes are undeniable. All these Democrats should, number one, call up Robert Hur that's blistered him onto his face and to on other shows for his conduct during that investigation. They should have complimented him.
Seriously, he saved their butts. But the big question here, I think it's easy to get lost in the weeds. Well, when did he have cancer and when did he find out and what was his treatment and, you know, what was happening in the White House at that time? I want to know, given what we know about his mental state and what he was going through, who is actually executing the authorities and offices of the presidency? That's the only thing I care about.
I think it's Jill and Hunter. I really do. When I found out the cabinet secretaries felt as though they didn't have access to him, I know they're trying to cover their own butts, but for the most part, they never had cabinet meetings. And then we find out other aides didn't. Then you wonder who's that close circle. And that close circle is his wife and Hunter. Was with him all the time. You know, in the beginning, they said to keep an eye on him. Now I think he was basically running things.
Yeah, and then you also have to wonder about, we had a former president who's pretty popular at the time, won two terms, living in the middle of D.C., who has figured out how to get a bunch of his former aides, people like
Susan
Jake
Rice.
Sullivan in there, Susan Rice in there. What was Obama's role in all of this? Because to me, he's the dog that didn't bark. He's in the middle of D.C. You know everyone's talking to him. You know he's talking to everyone. And yet we never heard a whisper about who he was meeting with, who he was talking to, what his aides were doing. So to me, like, you know, I hope Joe Biden gets healthy. I hope he gets over this. But for the sake of the country, we need to know who is actually calling the shots, who was using the auto pin, who was signing these pardons and these laws and these, you know, big political appointments, if it wasn't Joe Biden. We deserve to have answers to those questions.
Sean, we had no president for 4 years. And they had people like Chris Coons. Joe Biden is great. And she went to bat for him even after that debate. I mean, he had to have, if anybody. He took Biden's Senate seat from Delaware, talking to the family all the time. He had to have had moments that Robert Hur had when you ask him questions and he just zones out or walks out or falls asleep. And he kept that secret and said the exact opposite in front of people. I just think that for Democrats coming off the Russia scandal, which didn't exist, the laptop that was real that they told us it wasn't, and now this, why would you believe anything they said about anything? I'm talking about dozens of leading Democrats who had to be in on this.
They either had to be in on it or they had to be, you know, maybe they weren't read in totally on what was going on, but they certainly were playing along. And look, it's not like Joe Biden burst on the political scene in 2019 for the first time. He's been in politics for like 500 years. Okay, he was vice president for 8 years. We all remember how combative and feisty he was in that debate with Paul Ryan in 2012. Like, that's the punchy, aggressive Joe Biden that everyone remembers. And then suddenly when he ran for president, a very, very different person, we were all just supposed to pretend, yeah, this is how he's always been. He's always just been lovable, soft, cuddly little Uncle Joe. That was never the truth. And the people who spent their careers around him, they knew it wasn't the truth, and they decided to play along anyway.
I want you to hear what Van Jones said as a commentator. He also said nice things about him as a person, but said this about the party, Cut 32.
I was shocked to see his condition when he came out, and so was the world. And that wasn't the first time he was in that condition. The book makes it very, very clear. There are people who knew and said nothing. And that is a crime against this republic. And I think the Democrats are going to pay for a long time for being a part of what is now being revealed to be a massive cover-up.
Right. And that's just it. And think of some of the horrendous decisions that have taken place or the non-decisions that happened. He kept denying that the border was broken. But tens of millions of people got through. The crime that happened, the victims here, the TDA that has come over and infected almost every major city. This happened and nothing's worse in Afghanistan. I mean, how could you be a sitting general, talk about ethics and patriotism, look over at this guy, see how incomprehensible his decision was, see him being unable to put two sentences together and say, okay, sir, sounds good to me.
You know, I actually like Van Jones' optimism there that people will immediately and suddenly hold Democrats accountable for this long con job they ran on everyone. I'm unfortunately a little more cynical than he is. Because you think about the list of stuff you just rattled off, Russiagate, the border, the laptop, all the censorship, all the lies about COVID. They've been doing it for years and years and years. And unfortunately, they're able to do it with the help of a completely complicit corporate media that just goes along with it. And so, yeah, I want to know who in government was involved, but there needs to be a reckoning for everyone in media. People like Joe Scarborough, who came out after that debate and said, oh, it's the sharpest Joe Biden I've ever been. There has to be some sort of reckoning for people like him, for people like Jake Tapper, who fed these lies to the American people that they knew were lies for years.
Yeah, how much money he probably got already to write the book? So he doesn't care. So he doesn't care about his credibility. No one at CNN is going to give him a hard time. But here's the thing. If someone at Fox wrote the book, you know, let's say Sean Hannity wrote this book and said, here it is. CNN, MSNBC would just ignore it, say it's partisan. But when you have a CNN anchor write the book and ignore it and give him a pass on the story that he ignored and act like he's a truth teller. So now how do you avoid it? Your buddy, the anchor, wrote the book on the Democratic network, MSNBC. They have more details of it. Joe Scarborough has got to try to rehab his career. Now look at James Clyburn. Nobody's more responsible for Joe Biden being president than James Clyburn. Here's what he said. Cut 36.
So it's not about age, it's about the ability to do the job. And I never saw anything that allowed me to think that Joe Biden was not able to do the job. It's just that simple.
Cut 35.
I never saw anything I thought was unusual. Did he talk as swiftly as he used to talk? No, he didn't. Did he walk as swiftly? No, he didn't. But that is to be expected.
Do you really believe that he believes that? Because he was he does say he talks to him regularly. I mean, how could you possibly believe that?
Yeah, no, I'm not sure he believes it. If he believes that, I mean, heaven help him, man, because that's a level of self-delusion that I think is remarkable, even in politics. But the thing is, he's actually right. He was right at the beginning where he said it's not age that matters, it's your ability to do the job. And that's very true, because look at Donald Trump. The guy's almost 80, and he's an Energizer bunny. He seems to sleep like 5 minutes a night, and he's got more energy than all of us. And yet, do you remember how the White House press corps jumped down his throat and tried to destroy Dr. Ronny Jackson a couple years ago when he came out and was like, yeah, Trump, he doesn't eat great and he drinks Diet Coke all the time, but he's actually like kind of in shockingly good health. And they lost their minds over it. So it's this back and forth bizarro world where they pretend that like Trump is on death's door and Biden was the picture of health and vitality, when the reality is the exact opposite. And it's just, it's maddening to watch, because they're going to do it this week and we're going to eventually forget about it. And they're going to do the exact same thing again with their next little hysteria a week from now. And it's at some point the cycle just has to end.
I would think so. You can't look ahead if you're not going to be if you're going to have all these books and the Heard tapes coming out now. And Joe Biden, this, you know, it's a terrible diagnosis no matter when he got it. But it's very hard for me to believe that he just got that yesterday or the day before. But Sean, I want to ask you about the big, beautiful bill. And Chip Roy, fellow Texan, he's holding out, says not enough spending cut. He decided to vote present, along with three others. And we know that the Republicans in blue states, like the one I'm in New York and in California, they're holding out for SALT. Do you see this coming together before Memorial Day? Because the general floor vote, they would go down right now.
It's so hard to tell. The margin in the House is so thin and you've got so many factions. I don't want to have to put my credibility on the line by guessing what they're going to do. I think they're eventually going to get to an agreement. But I hope, given the fiscal straits that we're in right now, we've got almost $40 trillion worth of debt. It's not going down anytime soon. I hope that everyone in Congress, whether they're conservative or liberal or Republican or Democrat, would fully understand the fiscal situation and what we're facing. And no, you can't just kick down the can down the road another week or another month, because the longer we go without fixing this, the harder and more painful it's going to get. And we might actually get to the point where it's not fixable anymore. So I hope they can all get together and actually fix the problems and not just try and paper over stuff so they can get a press release out about the bill they passed.
Senator Ron Johnson said, we have revenues hitting an all-time high too. And if we just kept to pre-pandemic spending, we'd actually almost have a balanced budget at $4.5 trillion. But now it's over six because we never brought down the spending after the pandemic, which is insane to me. And they want to, and the Texas guys are doing this. They say, let's get rid of parts of the new Green Deal. There's too much still left here. But the problem is, in some of those states, those are popular programs with electric car, the windmills, or some of this green stuff. And that would hurt them in winning re-election. So that's a problem. If you have this bill, but you lose the House in a year and a half, is it worth it?
Well, I mean, so I used to work for Tom Coburn in the Senate. He was called Dr. No.
Sure.
The man was a force of nature. And he said, look, you got to stop worrying about what's going to happen in your election tomorrow. And you have to start worrying about what's going to happen to your grandchildren's future. And so that's kind of just been my political compass my whole career. You have to do what's right for the country. And if doing what's right means you lose your seat, man, you should be able to hold your head high and walk out. But unfortunately, it's not a partisan thing. It's a problem on the right and on the left. These people care more about keeping their jobs and keeping the perks than they do in saving the country. And I'll tell you, the country going down the tubes, the dollar losing all its value, us going down an inflationary spiral, that's going to be a heck of a lot more painful than losing a political seat.
Sean Davis, thanks so much. CEO and co-founder of The Federalist. Appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
All right, Sean Davis helping us out. 1-866-408-7669. I see you up there, Harold, Hank, Sandra. I'll try to get to your calls when we come back. Brian Kilmeade Show.
You're with Brian Kilmeade. A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
back of your head, too, you're just thinking to yourself as well, like, when you were on the Patriots, the whole goal was to eliminate all the distractions that can possibly happen, you know, while you're on the team. And don't bring those distractions to the team and in the locker room. And we're just looking, you know, down at the program in North Carolina, and it just feels like there's just distractions 24/7, you know, down there, and there's just no football talk at all. So that's what's kind of silly about it, and kind of questioning as well as what happened to eliminate every distraction. But it is what it is, and it's entertainment. It doesn't affect me.
No.
I enjoy, you know, watching the show.
And, of course, Gronkowski talking about what the book tour that Bill Belichick's on. He's still doing interviews. He started with Michael Strahan, started with CBS, started with Strahan, did a couple of others. And some stories are coming out in the book about things Tom Brady and oriented what basically on winning. But right now, Bill Belichick, what Gronkowski has brought up, who played for him in New England for years, just said the one thing about Belichick, he was all about eliminate all distractions. That's why he told Tom Brady's trainer to get out of there. They said, we don't want a special trainer just because you happen to be the best player. We think it's a distraction, so don't do it. Don't bring in distractions. And he brought his distraction, his 24-year-old girlfriend, who's a walking distraction. And I'm not saying that's bad, but it's extremely bad for a football coach with a different, totally different reputation. But I don't know. I don't even know how many book sales he's going to get. I mean, to tell you the truth, if I'm the publisher, I'm furious. Don't you think?
Well, absolutely. At the same time, if his girlfriend was really, quote unquote, working on the book, then she should have been involved in the meetings and all of that. Like, why wasn't someone from the publisher with him during those interviews instead of her speaking up?
Right. It takes a lot of planning. Unless, you know, a lot of times these guys are famous. They're busy. I'll sign you. I'm not going to bother you. It looks like you're set. You look like you're fine. And they'll just back off because maybe they're like starstruck with Belichick or they're intimidated by him.
I don't know. For a high profile book like that, they probably give him a ton of money. They want to make sure they're selling copies, right? And then having like a big interview like Sunday morning or it was just or on CBS that you want to make sure that goes well because when they go well, that's really boosting your sales. So to not have anyone from the publisher there to have her be quiet, right? Because the clip they showed, they said it was not the first time she spoke up. She was speaking up prior.
Evidently, she stopped the interview. So if CBS really wanted, I don't know who published it.
I'm assuming Simon and Schuster, but I have to look it up.
So if CBS really wanted to make this bad, they would publish the other times in which she interrupted. And unless, of course, it didn't happen.
Or unless they're, you know, the parent company is publishing the book and they don't want to. Right. The sales.
But I think the biggest story happens to be right now, the Knicks upset of the Celtics. Don't you agree? Tell me that wasn't the buzz all weekend, wherever you were in the Northeast. Pete, am I right?
Not only that, they were supposed to get swept. That was all the talking heads that they were going to get swept. Forget about them winning or extending the series beyond four or five games. They were supposed to be swept.
Right.
But I also laugh at the fan base from Boston. Instead of just being gracious, Knicks still stink, or... oh, I can't believe you guys are celebrating a round two win.
Right.
And well, it's Boston, a big win for the franchise.
You know, up until that series, Boston has been very gracious. They've been so down to earth and rational about their teams. But I will say this. This is what I hate. All these celebrities get the front row seats, and they don't pay for them. And, I mean, they're the people that can afford these front row seats. They're probably $25,000. What do you think? $20,000, I bet you.
At least, if not more.
Okay. They can afford it. You can tell me Ben Stiller can't pay for a seat? I mean, come on. That Timothy Chalamet can't pay for a seat? Now everybody else, no one can pay for a seat. So they go outside, and they say it's a bigger party outside on the flat screens in New York City streets than anything on the inside. So it's kind of this new thing that happened because no one can afford tickets in New York to Madison Square Garden.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
Hey there, it's me, Kennedy. Make sure to check out my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. It is 5 days a week, every week. Download and listen at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.